It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Trump campaign is suing in federal court to stop the certification of election results in Pennsylvania. Trump or Republican leaders have also filed suits in Michigan, Arizona, Nevada, and Georgia, and those actions have not resulted in a positive outcome for the president. WITF's Emily Previty has been covering the election, the many lawsuits during the campaign, and now the post-election suits. Emily, welcome back to the program.
Great to be here, Kevin.
First off, what is the Trump campaign claiming in this latest lawsuit filed this week in Pennsylvania?
This is a 105-page complaint, and it makes a lot of claims. Some are somewhat hyper-local or specific in nature, but some of the biggest or broadest claims include that Democratic majority counties, they afforded voters more opportunities to cure technical problems with mailed ballots before they were cast and counted, and that Republican majority counties did not do that, putting the president and his campaign at a disadvantage. So that was one of the big ones. The complaint also claims that the Trump campaign's watchers were not allowed to observe the canvassing of nearly 700,000 ballots in Philadelphia and Allegheny County.
Well, they actually won to allow their watchers to get a little closer in Philadelphia, didn't they?
Correct, they did.
The Republican majority counties, they could have also offered remedies to mail-in voters, could they not?
Yes, and they did. Some counties with more Republican voters registered than Democrats do the same thing or similar things, alerting voters if their affidavit on the exterior mailed ballot envelope hasn't been signed. Some Republican-leaning county election directors did tell me they limited their flagging of ballots technical errors to voters who cast them in person versus through the mail. And so then it's like, where do you draw the line? A few Republican-majority counties, Lancaster is one example here, they've said they changed their approach or stopped altogether due to this issue coming up in a lawsuit earlier this year. The plaintiffs in that case wanted all counties to be required to notify voters, which the state Supreme Court ultimately declined to agree to because it held that this issue was a statutory matter. So nothing like materially changed with the law, but that's the reason Lancaster and some other counties cited for changing their approach on this.
The lawsuit is targeting Allegheny Center and Philadelphia areas. So why not the whole state? Just because of the Democratic registration in those counties?
That seems to be part of it. And then there are claims about more individual, hyper-specific, hyper-local examples that deal with in-person voting as far as issuing provisional ballots to certain voters that the campaign argues shouldn't have been issued provisional ballots, for example, at one precinct. It basically claims that those counties didn't follow procedures, which the rest of the state did. With at least one, I can tell you that's not exactly accurate. But as I said, there are many claims in this lawsuit. If it does make it to court, we would hope to have more specific information supporting some of these claims than is available in the complaint. And even sooner than that, or before it gets to that stage, with some of the filings that are due within the next week.
Mm-hmm. Has anybody that you've spoken with, aside from lawyers for the president's campaign, made any credible allegations of claims of fraud?
No, and I don't know that the campaign's attorneys really have either. Our own reporters are out all over the place, all over the state, and in touch with election workers and officials, voting rights advocates and candidates and political party leaders, and we really weren't hearing specific examples of this. And even some of the concerns raised separately by state lawmakers, mainly Republicans, after the election, when we've asked them for specifics as far as which counties and so forth, they haven't been able to provide it.
The president's legal actions have not been successful in other states that were highly contested, just like Pennsylvania. What are experts telling you about the chances of this latest lawsuit in Pennsylvania? What have you heard?
They have said that it's a long shot for a number of reasons, one being that courts generally avoid disenfranchising voters that haven't themselves made a mistake, so the voter follows the rules as they were at the time of the election. In this case, if the court does side with the Trump campaign, it would be forward-looking. It would address procedure in future elections. That's what I've been told. They also pointed out that you know, variation among local jurisdictions, local election jurisdictions, is kind of a hallmark of our voting system, not only in Pennsylvania, but just the fact the timing of this lawsuit and the resources and bandwidth that it might demand from the Department of State and some of those counties that do have such a high percentage of our registered voters in Pennsylvania at a time when they're trying to get through vote processing so these results can get certified on time. That is something to potentially be concerned about.
WITF reporter Emily Previty. Thanks so much, Emily.
Thank you, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The 8-0 Pittsburgh Steelers. Sounds pretty good. In fact, we've never been able to say that before. The franchise's previous best start was 7-0 in 1978, a season which ended with the Steelers' third Super Bowl title. Sean Gentile is a senior writer for The Athletic. Sean, welcome back to the program.
Kevin, thanks for having me.
Sean, you weren't around in 78, but I can tell you, those Steelers were dominant. Can you say that these 8-0 Steelers are dominant?
You know, it's a funny thing. I think by definition, an 8-0 team has to be dominant on some level, right? But I do think there's kind of a fair question about this team, particularly because of the way the last 3 weeks have gone. They really haven't put together a 60-minute game, so to speak.
Well, you mentioned the last three wins. So it was at Tennessee, really good first half, and then they hung on in the second half as the Titans rallied. Then in Baltimore, oh, a very bad first half, but the Steelers rallied to win in the second half. And most recently this past Sunday, it was, wouldn't you say, it was kind of ugly throughout the game, trailing almost the entire contest to a 2-6 Dallas team using a fourth-string quarterback.
A 2-6 Dallas team who was using a quarterback who was unemployed until the middle of October. Yeah, it was a wild game to watch. There were some special teams mistakes. There was the obligatory Ben Roethlisberger injury. You know, it was the kind of game that in the past has really trapped them up. And I think that's as good a sign of any, is that, you know, they're, if nothing else, they're managing to beat bad teams. They're not playing all the way down to their level. And I think there's something to be said for that. There's something to be said for just putting wins on the board. And I think they've done a great job with that, obviously.
We can't. Steeler fans can't be happy. We can't be satisfied with an 8-0 team. Baltimore ran all over the defense, well over 200 yards. Dallas racked up, I believe it was 144 yards on the ground. So are you more concerned with an offense that often gets off to a very slow, sluggish start, or a defense that's given up quite a few yards on the ground?
It's a tough one to answer, because they're 8-0 for a reason, and I think part of that is that there's no real glaring weakness. Like, yes, you can say that the offense hadn't scored enough points, but, you know, it's really impressive to watch Ben Roethlisberger on and on. Yes, there are issues maybe over the last couple of weeks with stopping the run, but then you have a really opportunistic, timely defense that, you know, is forcing turnovers and all that. So there's not really any one runaway weakness, but I still think that we need to track, you know, how they are performing in the middle of the field at that middle linebacker spot, whether that's, you know, fortifying against the run or whether it's how they match up against, say, tall tight ends. You know, I think that's the issue outstanding. And then of course, as far as the offense is concerned, it all hinges on Ben Roethlisberger's health. You know, we saw him leave for a minute on Sunday with a banged up knee, and then, you know, that was a season flashing before their eyes kind of thing.
So Sean Gentile's verdict: Steelers are lucky. The Steelers are very good.
Absolutely, you said it better than me, Kevin. Absolutely, it takes a little bit of both to go 8-0 in the NFL. There's a reason it doesn't happen all that often. You have to have the stars kind of aligned, and I think they've had everything on their side. This is a really good team that's also gotten a few breaks.
So Sean, the Steelers host Cincinnati Sunday before traveling to Jacksonville. When the Steelers are back home Thanksgiving night to host Baltimore, will they be 10-0? I'm going to give you a little hedge here because we don't know if Ben is going to play against Cincinnati because he's on the reserve COVID list.
Yeah, it was a rough week for the NFL. 56 people or staff members, players tested positive this week. And Roethlisberger's status is in doubt. It all kind of hinges on whether he tests negative twice during this week. Whether he plays against the Bengals remains to be seen. And I think this game was always a little bit of a sneaky kind of trap game for them. Joe Burrow was the number one pick, Heisman Trophy winner coming out of college last year. He's been really good. The team's been a little bit more competitive than anticipated. I think the Steelers were primed to drop one, even under the best of circumstances. I think a loss could be on the board here, but I still think the perfect record's all going to come down to that game against the Ravens back here on Thanksgiving night.
Sean Gentile is a senior writer for The Athletic. Thanks so much, Sean.
You bet, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Film Pittsburgh Fall Festival got underway yesterday and continues through November 22nd with 30 independent and foreign language feature films and 20 shorts programs. The festival is completely virtual. Catherine Spitz-Cohan is Executive Director of Film Pittsburgh. Welcome back to The Confluence.
Oh, Kevin, it's so great to talk to you.
So the Fall Festival is actually a coming together of several film festivals. The Three Rivers Film Festival, which the Pittsburgh Center for the Arts and Media was no longer going to present, plus festivals that Film Pittsburgh always presents. Pittsburgh Shorts, J-Film, the Jewish-themed event, and Real Abilities, which showcases the stories of people with disabilities. Catherine, any special challenges for blending all these together? Did you have to make even maybe more difficult decisions than usual on what to include?
It actually was more work in total to do all these festivals at once. But I think it lends itself really well to do so, especially in this COVID environment. So I think it was well worth the extra effort. In terms of selecting the films, I think that it's always challenging because there are so many great films made each year. I don't think that it was made more challenging. I think the fact that we had 12 days and really did not have to adhere to a time slot. We would show a film or a block of films, if you're talking short films, once or twice at the most. Now, because most of the offerings are available for the entire run of the festival, and people can watch on their own schedule, I think that allowed us to include 20 blocks of short films. So that's 137 short films that we're offering.
Wow.
And I think in the past, we never got that high. Mm-hmm. I think maybe we were a little bit over 100 last year. In a way, I think it was good that we liked the sound of 20 shorts blocks and 30 feature films.
Mm-hmm. Catherine, how do you adequately combine the intention of these different festivals into one?
The intention behind all of our festivals is the same. It's our mission to bring people together, whether it's in person or not, but using film as a tool to show universal desires and common aspects of who we are as people, or to educate and show someone living in another part of the world that might be struggling in a way that you never thought about before. And I think all of these festivals do that.
Yeah. You have a mix of genres, dramas, comedies, documentaries, and animated features, and of course the shorts. You always like to highlight the local artistic talent. Tell us briefly about maybe one locally produced film or one filmmaker that you're excited about.
Well, that's hard because they're all my babies. We do pay extra special attention to local films and local filmmakers. And it could be somebody who grew up here and moved away. It could be somebody who lives here now. Our opening night film was produced by a local producer who moved here several years ago, now calls Pittsburgh her home. That film, I'm pleased to announce, was shown last night. We are going to be opening up the ability to see that film throughout the run of the festival.
So that's Freeland?
I'm excited. Freeland, yeah. So some of the other films that come to mind are short films. So there were a number of short films that were made during the pandemic, and they are included in our short films blocks. One is called Loopy, and one is called Submit It to Festivals, and another one is called Saving Amelia. All three of those films have local connections and were shot here locally, and were all shot during the pandemic. And I mean, talk about creative people making good use of their time.
Do you think that some of these films, their impact or meaning changes when fit onto a small screen or monitor rather than viewed in a theater?
I do. Truth be told, I watch all of the films that we're considering on my laptop. And then when we would get to a movie theater, so I'd watch it again, and I would be often thinking about how amazing it is to see that same content that I watched on a small screen on the big screen. I know that some people, my 23-year-old daughter, will be watching on her phone, which just blows my mind because I can't imagine ever watching a film on my phone. But I know people do it. And to me, the laptop is about as small as I can get.
Catherine, are you going to miss the buzz? People leaving the theaters chatting about what they've just seen.
I am not able to connect with the audiences, and that is so sad to me. It is one of my favorite parts of all of the festivals that we do. As patrons file out from the theater after having just seen a film, talking about the films in a way that is so rewarding. And yes, I will miss it. So it's just another aspect of living life right now that is sad and that I look forward to getting back to.
Catherine Spitz-Cohan is the executive director of Film Pittsburgh, which is presenting the Film Pittsburgh Fall Festival now through November 22nd, all virtual. Catherine, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, Kevin, it is my pleasure.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Julia Zenkovich, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.